And I'm actually, I probably won't, maybe I'll have time to do it tomorrow. So.
He's full. He's supposed to. I didn't see him though. Mike. Put it on.
Okay. Well. Can you get off your line?
What's up?
Finally, but I haven't even. I got a newborn in October, so I'm kind of like keeping away from that.
Right. Yeah. Forever. See.
Really stuck on the track the other day.
Yep.
Are you guys
getting out?
You're in. Are you off across the camera? I started working with Rob Morris standing, so it seemed like. Been joking with all the trappers. I've been handling more fur this year than I've ever had. You guys are doing it wrong.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So we're going to go ahead and call the orders for Fairbanks Fishing Game Advisory Committee meeting Wednesday, December 12th. It is 18:04. Roll call. Present. Mark Richards.
Present.
Austin Smith.
Present.
Gil Vick.
Present. Online.
Jeff Lucas.
Here.
Virgil Umpenhauer.
He's at the hospital, Mr. Chair.
What's that?
He's at the hospital.
He's at the hospital with his wife.
He's excused.
He's excused. Bill Lowry.
Yeah.
Okay. Don Wisniewski.
Don is at the Western Arctic Neighborhood Working Group. He's excused.
Levi Llewellyn.
Here.
Gabriel Davis.
Here.
Mike Tinker.
He's in Florida. He's accused.
Warren Juki.
Here.
Mike Kramer.
Don't know about that.
Derek?
Yeah.
Lance Nelson?
Here.
And we have John Haddix?
Here.
There we go. We have a quorum. Okay, the fishing game staff that's present will go ahead and introduce himself.
Tony Holland, Fairbanks area.
Okay, let's go ahead and introduce any guests.
Well, what are you, let's get Dina and Andy and the other fishing game staff online.
Go online if you go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, yeah, thanks. This is Dina Jallon with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the Yukon River summer season manager.
Andy? Sure, Andy Griska, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Sport Fish, Canada Area Management Biologist.
Christy?
Yeah, Christy Gleason, Yukon Area Fall Season Manager.
We can go ahead online and introduce our guests. We'll start with Betty Ross.
Betty Ross, Deputy Director of Canada Chiefs Conference.
Diane and Lenny.
Diane and Lenny Jukes.
Okay. Forrest Bowers, ABFG.
Ask who's the phone number ending in 168.
Whose phone number ends in 168? Online.
He's unmuted.
That's Katie Harp, interested party.
Can you say your name again, please?
Katie Harms.
Thank you.
Thank you. Guest presence here, present here with us today.
Eric? Can you say your name one more time, here?
All right, one more time. How do you say the last name? A&F? Thanks, guys.
Approval of the agenda.
So we don't have the agenda from the last meeting. Gail, were you working on that agenda? We weren't sure if you were going to do those minutes from the last meeting.
Not from the last meeting that I understand. I can do them, but I thought we had a new secretary, and we didn't have a discussion on that.
Okay, Austin just said he'd go back and do them.
Oh, okay, thank you.
That's approval.
Okay, a bunch of others.
Bring that up at the next meeting.
Okay, chair report. The only thing I have to say is that last week, Mark and I drove Delta to attend a Delta AC meeting to learn more about what their concerns are, proposals that they're interested in. There was a really good briefing with Bob and Earl. Bob's here this evening to talk to us along with Earl about the buffalo, the bison herd, and after we invited them, so we're waiting on Earl here. Other than that, I don't have anything else, Mark.
No, I don't have anything else at this time. I just want to recognize that is that Kathy Harms or Katie Harms on the phone online?
Yeah.
Is that you, Kathy?
Katie Harms.
Katie Harms. I'm confusing you with the other Kathy Harms, I guess. And Forrest is here. Let's see if we have recognized him already.
ADFGD staff report with Delta Junction Bison Tony, status.
Yeah, Tony's going to give a report first.
A couple things from the survey area. We finished up our 20 people survey, which, I don't have all the numbers calculated, but I have the preliminary numbers, and it's definitely decreased the population. You know, this is the first time we surveyed 20 bees since the 2021 year. This last fall we did 28. 28 had about a 20% decline in the population, and from preliminary numbers, I'm not going to say what that is right now, other than it appears probably closer to a 30% decline in 20 feet. The positive side of that is the bull-cow ratio is fairly decent. It's still below our objective of 30, but it looks like it's going to be around 25, which is better than the last season. And then because we have a year between the hard winter and when we serve it last winter, I think the recovery is already beginning because we have a really high cow-to-calf ratio of almost 40 calves per 100 cows, which is a response to something like that when they're in the cows. So that's that. Next meeting, I'll have those numbers crunched and see exactly where we're at and think we're at as a report to you guys. But I just wanted to let it out that it's definitely down, which I expected, but I wasn't sure. I was hoping it wasn't. That only may be equal to what 28 is, but it appears it might be a little harsher on the side of it. In other news, we have this last month, there's a big project that has begun with our department. We have a grad student running it. We're collaring a bunch of bull moose. We collared 30 bull moose out by Galena, out by McGrath, and then we put 30 collars on bulls in Minto Flats. And what we're going to look at is the movement of these bull moose. We're going to see, look at that, but we're also going to compare when we do our surveys where these bulls are compared to where they are during hunting season. So it's a pretty exciting, it's all sat collars. I can follow these things every day if I want to. So Chuck, don't get any ideas. Yeah, right. So, but yeah, so right now for this area, Mitchell Flats is 30 bulls of pretty much all age classes above yearly.
And what were the other two again,
Tom? Out in Galena by 3 Day Slough on the Kayakar, and then out near McGrath.
And that's 30 each.
30 each, yeah, and then there'll be another 30 probably going out next year in each spot. So. And then Jeff has a picture, so if you're wondering
number for 20 feet. Do you see that affecting allocation for hunting or hunting season at all? If those things
I don't. If the bull cow ratio is good, I'm still waiting for the last of the harvest to come in. But if we're still harvesting, I mean, there's still harvestable surplus at 5%, you know. So if we're still in that range, then, you know, there's not a lot. Then it's not really hunting that caused it. It was just weather. And so it may just be a few years of tougher hunting for people. Well, we actually are gonna, we're supposed to do it today and it didn't happen, but we're gonna have discussions on that as a region wide. So that's in the talks. You know, we get a lot of, let's say, climate change used within population, explaining population decline. Crappier weather, snow. Is it real or not? It appears to, you know, especially South Central really sees it. Comes in these sheep talks, comes in these caribou talks with a decline. And so the crux of this conversation is, well, I mean, we use it with all these animals. What about hunters? You know, it's tougher hunting now in early September because it gets cold later. It's still like August after shooting. So that'll be that discussion. But that's got to be... If you did something in Fairbanks like extend the season to the 30th, you know, it's a shorter season, but it's at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. That'd be a big target for everyone down south that didn't get a moose, you know, to come to a 30-day season. So we would have to deal with that, which we could, which might mean a really short season. So that's some of the discussion.
Tony, so in talking to biologists, they say the photo period is the main thing that influences the rut. So is these later seasons influencing the rut, or is it really just about
photo period? I don't think we're seeing that. Because our, you know, our meat, we look at, especially here around Fairbanks for our 20 survey, we got all these radio collar cows, and we're not seeing birth, the peak day of birth
later.
It's still around the same time. But that doesn't mean that things like this year where the leaf stayed on and other factors may really make hunting difficult. So, anyway, this may be a long, long conversation, but it's going to be a conversation.
And one more thing, what did you see on your survey of 20 wolves? Well, did you see any large wolf packs?
I don't think anybody saw any large wolf. Somebody saw tracks of what they called teams. That was down on the Telavane country. I don't know if anybody saw it. People saw wolves in different areas. There's certainly. Nobody saw wolf packs.
Yeah, just real quick, it's more of an FMI, but I'm just letting you guys know the department is, has some habitat work planned in the Nana Ridge area this winter. Tony and I are involved enough to run in it. The department has two people that are focused on habitat stuff, but there's some areas that were treated in the Nana Ridge way back late 90s, early 2000s, and so it's going back in and retreating them. So treating them, meaning going into the dozer and a roller chopper to basically mow down mostly aspen areas and then that re-sprouts. And so it's just for grouse and moose habitat. So 160 acres is not a landscape scale type thing, but so I got the map. If anybody's curious, you guys can
Go to the can you give your name just for
the yeah. Yeah, well. Yeah. Yeah.
So on that clear spot or
just bottom? So these areas they originally treated in the late 90s, 2000s, they were kind of doing an experimental design. They burned some of them, they clear cut, they use a dozer. But this time, they're going in the same areas, but they're just going to use a dozer and a roller chopper. It's a pretty effective way of going in the winter and effective with species areas. So, for not a huge. So we kind of, not contract, but forestry has all this equipment, and they don't have a lot going on in the winter, so we can basically pay their operators if they got the equipment and going into the winter stuff. And we've done the same thing, Delta and Coke and that kind of same model, and it works pretty well.
And there's a thing there that
they do. Well, what lousy. You can only hear every other word.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, maybe we need to, I'll pass it off to Bob, but maybe we need to hold it closer. Is that better?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, guys. There's been some questions from lots of people. I think they saw the drought supplement, and holy cow, there's a lot of bison permits, especially after the tough winter a couple of years ago.
Just one. Lenny and Diane, can you hear Bob when he's talking right now? Or people online, can you hear Bob?
I can. It seems like he fades in and out, in and out.
Yeah, she does fade in and out.
Connection. I'm checking on.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead, Bob. Sorry. Yeah. So there's a long history with Delta bison. They released there in 1928, and everything was going pretty good up until the late 70s. There was good herd growth. Hunting started in the 50s, and then the Delta Ag Project was created in the late 70s, and that's where the conflict started. So through the years, there was the Delta Bison Working Group that was created and a series of management plans that came out of there, and everybody kind of had a say on what the management objective would be. The numbers fluctuated over the years, but it's been pretty consistently 360 in the last decade or more. So with that, we've never actually been allowed to see what the actual carrying capacity is of Delta bison. It's been a social carrying capacity. How many bison will the farmers tolerate? And so that's where these numbers come from. We are hoping, Earl McNabb from Delta was going to come on, if he's going to make it or not, but there's a big grant that people of Delta put in and got, Kronk and some other politicians behind them, and to do a bunch of
bison work on the bison range, habitat work, to the thought is to create more habitat south of the highway that might keep them, you know, off the farms longer. I don't know if that'll work or not, but that's the thought process, and to get everybody to come together, and it's going to give DNR some ownership, a little more than perhaps what they've had previously. So I would hope that when that all gets done, that we can increase the herd size, which would mean the farmers tolerating more. Right now, 360 is what they tolerate. So with that, I have a handout that there's some floating around. If you guys didn't all get one, just to show where these numbers come from, there was actually one of our researchers developed this app to plug in the numbers and get it more precise on the permit allocation versus, you know, more of the seat of the pants kind of the deal. So currently, actually, pre this hunting season, the hunting season started October 1st, and so going into this hunting season, we had 479 total bison, which is the first sheet of your handout, with 377 adults and 102 calves, and a bull cow ratio of about 37, which is a little bit below our objective. So historically, these numbers have been really tough to meet. It's just, if you have one year that the hunting is poorer, it knocks everything out of whack for several years. And then that's what happened pre the 2021-2022 year. That was a bad winter year. Some of the locals said, hey, I think there's too many bison, which a lot of people would like to see too many bison, or more bison, but they weren't seeing it that way. And then anyways, a bunch of them died that winter, which was perhaps a good thing that we had a surplus because of the number that died. But anyways, we curtailed the hunting last year, the 2022-2023 season, and they, you know, come back like nothing happened now pretty much already. So in order to meet that 360, going to your next page of the handout, if you flip over one, we're anticipating this year, so there was 60 total permits, so we're anticipating pretty close to 100% success, 56 total, and then with a little bit of, you know, natural mortality, which is low in bison, very low, we're anticipating when this March 31st comes, when hunting's over, we'll have 403 bison, which is already 40 over our objective. So then that's where we get into next year, what you're seeing in the supplement. So that's the next page. So we have some calves this spring. We, you know, estimate that that's going to be about 105 calves, we figure, with what the average normally is. So that puts us at 509 pre-hunting next fall. And again, 360 is our objective. So in order to make that, you flip again, that's where you're seeing that high number of permits in the supplement with 60. It was 60 and 65 was what was in the supplement. 60 either sex, or 65 either sex, 60 cow, and figuring almost 100% success rate again out of those, you would kill 90 cows and 30 bulls. And then that's the very next page we get to, that's the last couple pages, they just show it differently the same way, but 373 bison about when the smoke cleared at the end of next hunting season. So this just kind of walks you through the timeline on the number of bison that we need to take in order to get back pretty close to that 360. So, and this is probably perhaps the most accurate we've ever been using this app, plug the numbers in and see what it spits out. So yeah, that's where we're at currently until we, you know, maybe get some tolerance of, being able to have more bison. But this is the number we need to have to get close to that 360.
What's your target bull cow ratio?
It's 50. So, which is, you know, you don't need that many. That's a lot higher on the, what we do for bison than we do for moose and whatnot. 30 is still an acceptable number, and it's really hard to hit. Those numbers are counterintuitive, and you know, if you're managing for maximum sustained yield, you can do that better, but when you bring it down on purpose, so, you know, that's, I get it, when you see the supplement, 135 permits, and they just lost 40%, well, we can kill without on a normal year without any winter mortality, which is every single year ever except 2 winters ago, we can kill 20% or so of the herd and maintain. So not if you've got a surplus, you got to kill more than 20%. So they're very productive. So that's where we're at.
Questions?
Yes. So we did two different tags. So that's actually how it kind of was this year. Right, so
yeah,
theoretically you could, and then you can use that EO, you know, tool that you just mentioned, but that's never happened. People want to shoot bulls. That's just what they do. This year I've been surprised. We actually advertised the hunt last year for the current hunting season as bull only, and then we got the serving numbers of sprint. You know, we got to take a few cows. So we had a cow quota, so we turned the tag into either sex for this current hunting season, but then had a cow quota. And I didn't think it would get met, because such few people hardly shoot cows, but it was met right away. So there is that potential, but there's way more cows in the landscape. That's why this full cow ratio is low, and that's where we're going to, you know, whack the cows pretty good. It's not that there's a lack of bulls, just a lot of cows. So that would be a problem, though, if everybody did shoot a cow. If it was 130 cows, I don't think that would happen, but yes, we have that emergency order tool. And quick reporting. I got a 2-day reporting requirement.
So if we kill the cows, we want everything gets down the way it wants to be, and we have a bad weather, how long does it take to get that?
So that's what does suck about this. This doesn't give us the error, the caution. We lost that bad winter. We had about 600 bison, which was near and double than what we were supposed to have. And we didn't curtail the hunting because we didn't think the natural mortality would be that bad. So when the smoke cleared that year, we took 100 deer hunting and almost 200 died because of the winter. And there's no reason to believe that if you would have had less bison, that less would have died. It could have been just as many. You know, it would have just been additive mortality. So, a couple things. If we were to, you know, I guess now we know Delta bison have never faced anything like that. So if we get a December snowstorm with a 2-inch ice crust, maybe we should just shut hunting down that season instead of punting it for the next season. So that's a tool, this is going to be angry people, which is going to be angry people no matter what. So that's a tool, and then yeah, just curtailing hunting. Maybe not. If we had a 40% mortality on this number versus the 620, it would take more than a year to come back, which is what it took this time. So, but that's the world we live in.
And so, we bring up the 1928, there was no farming project, no farmers down there.
You know, I don't want to get into that. I can't pick sides, but yes, the bison were there a long time before the farmers, and there's a lot of political. Those farmers, I say 12 people because there's like 12 families that grow barley. They get a lot of, like this whole perhaps that could turn into $10 million. The farmers have a say in that. And the way I see it, this is my opinion, if we're not allowed to increase the herd size, most of the benefit would again go to the farmers. Now there is, like Earl would tell you if he was here, there is the fact that to get us all working together, that is a positive out of all that, because there's been a lot of this since 1979. So, that's what I say, so that winter, and always, there's so much, you know, negative. The politicians, I had Voucher calling me that I'm just going to say he wasn't maybe perhaps totally informed on everything that has happened and what's happening. And point is, they hear all this negative stuff, but they don't get the positive. You know, if it went on the ballot, let's say, my feeling, should we have more bison or should we not? I think it would pass by a lot because it's a few Delta folks that are against it. But there's this food security thing, you know, farming in Alaska, it's obviously was a thing in the 80s and now it's getting more push again. So, you know, both sides, that's why the working group was created, to represent both sides. So it's... there's not a lot of non-resident hunting, but the residents spend a lot of money, so we keep track of all that. All of the people that get a bison, they check out, and that's, we have a questionnaire, and that's on there. It's something like $2,000 in the state that an average bison hunter spends, and most of that's in Delta. So we have money spent in Delta and money spent in the state. So we have all that data. So it's, yeah, it's very valuable to the economics of the community and the state. And, you know, 40,000 people have been applying in the last decade. So it's super popular. So I encourage, you know, anybody that, you know, has something positive to say about Delta Bison to call up these same legislators that hear all the negative and tell them some positive things, because there is a lot of positive.
Some,
and that was another irritated me that winter. So the historic battles, which is why the Bison Rangers created, which, you know, all the whole history there, it was created to, you know, take the pressure off the private stuff. Bison were getting in the barley before it could be harvested, not necessarily eating it, maybe a little bit, but rolling in it, digging it out, you know, damaged that way. So the Bison Rangers was created, and all the legislation says to deter the migration or alter it until the barley harvest can be completed. Well, that, and then people started fencing in about 2010, and things were going really, you know, good, and then we started to accidentally get too many bison, and then I was gonna, you know, actually go to some of these, you know, people that don't like the bison, like, hey, things are going really well, what would you think about just letting this number ride? And before I could do that, that winter hit, shit, hit the fan. Like I said, there's less than 10. There's hay farmers and, yeah. And, but, so anyways, going back to that winter, so things were going pretty well. The main barley producers fenced. And then it was all these, let's call them hobby farmers that were complaining. Like, I mean, I was getting emails from the governor's office, like, you know, can you deal with this person? Because they were kind of newer. They weren't familiar. I mean, there was one lady asked, hey, am I going to have these issues every winter? Yeah, probably. And, but it was a thorn in my side because, you know, all this stuff that's, you know, it's in the politics again was a result of that winter, which is when they're quote unquote supposed to be allowed to be out in the north of the highway. Because all that legislation says until roughly October 1st, when the harvest can be completed, then they're allowed to go. You know, it's not that simple because they're wild animals without fences. But all these issues in that winter were during when they're supposed to be allowed on the ag project.
When the Delta Bison Group were first set up, there were very few for the other growing thing down there. Really affected the people south of the highway. Unfortunately, a lot of the farmers north of the highway started growing hay. There's a lot more hay north of the highway than south of the highway, so that's growing across the highway.
Yeah, and, you know, and so it's a small number of people, and, you know, try to, see both sides, and there's a small number of people, but there's ag data out there that most of the, you know, you go down to Alaska feed and buy a bale of hay or a bale of straw, most of that is coming from Delta. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the animal feed is indeed produced in Delta. Now, I would indeed agree with you that they put the ag project in the wrong spot, but that ship has long sailed, and now we just got to live with each other. So. Well, so I'm hoping, and even and Earl's McNabb, he works for Soil and Water, and so this money is actually being, the whole thing is kind of being ran by Soil and Water, because they kind of cut fishing game off, but they cut us out on purpose, because that side, Soil and Water, kind of represents the farmers more, and there's so much, you know, so much of this, that there was thought that if this proposal was to come from Fish and Game, the ag community might not be supportive of it. And I do have to agree that some of these folks, there ain't nothing you can tell them that is going to make you a hero. But so that is the value in this. Like, the vision of ag and the farm community is going to be heavily involved in this, and it's going to start, you know, next year sometime. And there's $1 million for sure that's happening that could turn into $4 million if PR match happens. And then it could turn even in the more in 2026. But at the end of the day, whether it does work or doesn't work, it's going to give Division of Ag and DNR a lot more ownership than they currently have. You know, through the years, you know, all my predecessors who looked through the notes and me, you know, when there's a problem, there's bison in my hay, there's bison in my cattle pen, you know, it's fish and game that responds. There's been very little response that I've noticed from DNR, Division of Ag. You know, they've got some money stuff, you know, for the fencing that was cost shared, but it's been fish and game out there on the ground trying to help. Often it's, you know, not much, but yeah, your hay is not the fence. Maybe you should work on that. So sometimes it's that simple, but when this all clears, you know, it will give Division of Ag a lot more work too. Like, because like if fish and game did all the work and it didn't work, they'd say we did it all. But if ag does the work and it doesn't work, they can't pin that on us now. So there's some value there. And I think people outside of Delta especially, it's not even all of Delta, it's the farm community, but that's a large chunk of Delta. There's some of them that would be, okay with no bison. And even when this all clears, some of them, they're telling us that they'd be okay with more, but I don't know if I believe them, I want to. But, so it's gonna take everybody else, like, hey, we spent, whether if it's $1 million, $4 million, or $10 million of Alaskan's money, what Alaskans get out of it is allowing the herd size to grow. So that needs to be remembered from, you know, from the people allocating this money. If we spend $4 million, $10 million, and we don't grow to herd size, who really benefited? I'm not going to say. You can connect the dots. But, yeah, that's where we're at. Yep.
Hey, go ahead.
Do you have a question? I thought I saw your hand up.
Can you, a couple things. First of all, your 37 to 100 that you said bull cow ratio is too low. What is the number you want for the bull cow ratio?
So the actual objective that's written down is 50 per 100.
Really?
Yeah.
So is that normal for bison then to have that high of a bull cow ratio?
It is higher. I don't know what the exact number is, but it, you know, would need to be that high for biological. You know, like moose. You know, we often have 25 to 30, but 12-15 will get the job done. So it's in hunter kind of fashion. People want to shoot bulls, so that's.
So, what? When does the Delta Bison Working Group meet again? Are they still actually formed?
That is a defunct group, okay. And I gotta dig. I don't think we're legally bound to follow the 360 anymore, but I also know the consequences is if we throw the book away and say we're not doing that.
But the Border Game approved that, right? That's a board approved?
I don't think
no.
That was approved.
Yeah, you were on it, John. John was on it.
And unfortunately, that 4 years we worked with the farmers, we worked with the number, and we never came back.
And they were very contentious meetings. I mean,
yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yeah. So that 350 number is not written in stone. Then,
no, and it's. Yeah, and the only thing that's written and codified says. We will develop management plans for the bison range and Delta bison, which we do with a, you know, regular, we call them SMRPs, enough species management report plan.
Yeah.
All that bison range stuff, all that stuff from a lot of the stuff from the working group is in our regular plan. So if somebody, you know, held us to like a legal, if you need to have a bison management plan, there is one. It's the species management report plan. But again, I know working with that, you know, people were getting quite upset that there were 600 bison on the landscape. So until the public says to do it, I'm not touching it.
So can you explain to the committee, since Earl's not here, like, first of all, so I think you said at the Delta meeting, so the department gets about $90,000 a year. You have one dozer that the department can use for bison?
Yep. So the bison range was established in the early 80s. It's evolved over time, but, you know, since the early 2000s, the budget was $40,000 to $50,000, and then probably in 2010 onward, it's been, you know, $70,000 to $90,000. And we've got a staff of one, full-time bison range person who also helps with other area office duties. And, yeah, one tractor, one dozer, so it's impossible to keep up. So there's, like, 3,000 acres that are cleared, but it's, there's only about 250 that are, you know, planted annually to oats and, you know, fresh bluegrass, and then there's a rotation. You mow a field that's getting out of reach before it gets all the way out of reach, and you keep that rotation going. So there's been, a lot of Delta people were, upset that way back in the 80s, the fee for when you apply for hunting bison, it went from $5 to $10. And a lot of people seem to remember that extra $5 was supposed to go directly toward Delta bison or Delta bison range management.
That wasn't true.
You need to come to Delta and say that. So there's no record that actually was the case. But
we decided during those meetings that would go into the general fund.
Right.
Because we got Pittman Roberts dollars for it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of understood that funding would come back to the Delta Bison range. But we consciously made the decision not to put it straight toward bison because we would not get Pittman Roberts dollars.
So there's a lot of people that remember that differently, and I read about it. You know, some of the old-time members.
I've never been strong advocacy for making it go only to the Delta Bison herd, but it was a cost of sufficient not to make it go.
So is that a separate budget item that you have to fight for every year to get that?
No, we get that $90,000. But the thought in the community is that that's not enough.
Right.
Now, and I mean, if you want to match, the bison range is 90,000 acres. There's 3,000 acres that are cleared. There's 250 or 300 that are planted, you know, every year. So yes, you could do more. However, people around there look at, you know, bison from a livestock lens that, you know, more food equals more bison. Well, that's not true because, you know, things like cattle, you know, they'll graze a spot to not when they're feeding good, they're going to stay there before they move to somewhere else. That's not what bison do. They're constantly moving. They take a few mouthfuls and they go explore and then they come back and they got good range still. So they never left the bison range because of a lack of food. So if there's not enough food in the bison range, there's plenty. You know, then you get into the argument, you know, quantity over quality. They say the stuff on the ag project is better quality, but mind you, the soil on the bison range is a lot worse, so it's actually harder to grow. So basically what happened was in the 80s, the folks developing the farm project deemed the land south of the highway wasn't good enough to develop an ag project, so they made it north of the highway. And then they started having all these conflicts. They said, here you go, fishing game. Have this land and grow better stuff than what's north of the highway. And so I don't know the answer to if we, you know, this grant that Earl's going to talk about, you know, could double the acreage in production. Maybe it'll keep them there longer because maybe they'll do a rotation that involves staying south of the highway more. But either way, like if you have the most great field of forage that's 200 acres and, you know, it's the most high quality food you can think of, they're not going to stay there because that's not what bison do. So maybe this will make them stay south of the highway longer, but I'm dubious.
But you're talking, so can you go into the money that went to the Soil and Water Conservation District and what they're supposedly going to do with that money?
Yeah, so, like I said, so they, as a result of that bad winter, that's when the books got opened that people were, you know, mad at fishing game and weren't doing enough because they were, you know, seeing them die along the highway, which, that kind of thing happens with these western bison herds. all the time. The difference is, in Delta that year, it was in the public eye. People were seeing it. So it was, you know, sad when you were seeing these bison look terrible. They looked terrible in the July. But, you know, they made it, and it came back great. You know, these other herds, if you have a reduction like this, like in Farwell, it's going to take triple the amount of time to come back. So anyways, people thought we should be doing more. It went back to the money thing. They thought they deserved all this money that they weren't getting through all these years. And, you know, they want a fishing game to maybe ask for more money. And we kind of said, well, with a staff of one, and you know, one tractor, if you dump $1 million on us, we can't use it. So then they went around us, the, you know, as members of the AC and the farming community, you know, whoever, a mixture of people. And they, you know, went to Kronk and some of these other politicians that they know and said, here's what's going on. We'd like some money. We feel like we can do more. And I honestly didn't think it would go anywhere, but it did. So, you know, they were, it was put together well. They put stuff in there like food security. You know, one of the members was, they represented both sides well on that proposal. Like, yeah, here's the farming side of it, but here's the, you know, bison side of it, the hunting public. The governor's all about food security. You know, you can argue there's more food security in these bison than there's that ag project. And that got talked about. And so between the food security thing and whatever, the governor pushed it through. And so then, like I said, soil and water kind of cut us out. But then they came back like, you know, we need to work with you. Here's why we cut you out, which I get. The farming community wants to support it. And now they're working with us because the fishing game has, or the money has to come through fishing game to match it with PR. So they want to turn that $1 million into $4 million. And then, like I said, there's more on the table for 2026. That has to come through fishing game. So what will probably happen is we're working on that now to get the money back, match it, and then we're going to give it right back to them. Because they are better equipped. They've got, you know, engineers and contractors. And so they are much more equipped to handle a scope of that big of a project than fishing game is. So no heartburn there. So their, you know, hope is to, yeah, to clear like another 3,000 acres, you know, expand. First off, clear some panels that got away from us, and then clear more land, and then have a higher rotation that's or more or less in production, and that's the goal. And you know, all the way through 2028 to slowly be clearing and then turning that into fields. And now there's no money beyond 2028. That's been talked about. So you're gonna do all this work, and they're like, well, if we can show that it did something, you know, the people in Juneau should give us more money. And I thought that was kind of crazy, and then you got talking about it some more, and it's like, well, at the end of the day, I guess you get a bunch of moose habitat. If you do all this work, and it just ends up growing back up, it will be moose habitat. So that, I guess that's the bottom line. You know, we do all this and then stop doing it, because it doesn't help the bison, which I'm not saying it's not going to. We don't know. So this will be a test, and as Earl would say if he was here, we're going to know. And, you know, I always say there's not enough production. There's not enough high-quality production. Well, that stuff's going to be tested now. So we will know.
Could you put, like, a big barrel in?
Mark, this is Mike Kramer.
There's some better.
And we do put, in the summer, we put a water source out there and mineral blocks and all these things to keep themselves as a highway. I mean, it's crazy. You've got a wild population. You've got water tanks. And, you know, salt licks, but it's to keep them off the ag project.
I was going to ask if there was any talk on any more water sources.
That is a part of it. So there'd be 2 to 3 more water sources developed out of this, and I'd like to see some ponds created because that's a lot more natural than a water tank. And so there is some good that can come out of this, absolutely.
So before Mike asks his question, I just wanted to, I did talk to Ryan Scott yesterday about this. He told me that the money is going to go through DNR, like an access project that we've done before, that we are going to get the PR funds.
Okay.
So it's going to run through DNR, and we're going to get the PR funds through that.
Yeah.
what he told me.
Okay, yeah, we were kind of thinking we'd get it, the PR fund. So that, if that's indeed true at Mark's stance, that means he's got for sure $4 million on the table.
He also said there will be no additional funding. Okay. This is going to be it.
Because that was the next line item was proposed for 2026, right. Another 1.5, which if you match that and combine it all together, you get 10. But based on what he's saying, you know, that's going to be $4 million. So will you be able to double? I mean, if we only got $1 million, that would probably only clear the panels that got away from us. Now, with $4 million, you know, you could expand the fields, do the water sources, but it's still not going to be probably as much as the ag community had hoped, but I don't know where the line is for those folks. So $4 million is still a lot of money.
How much do you spend on maintenance?
$90,000 a year. Yep.
With their
No, some annual, some perennial, just a mix.
Does that include salary for the one employee?
That is not the salary.
Okay.
So actually, it's half of the bison range manager. So out of the bison draw, so I've been told, those funds pay for all bison management in the state, which includes, you know, there's other sources too, but that's what that goes towards. And then part of my salary comes out of that, and then the entire bison range manager's salary comes out of that. So there's a lot of money spent, you know, every year on Delta Bison. But Tony, what's your entire Fairbanks area budget? You know, probably not $100,000. And we get $90,000 just for the bison range.
Mike, you got a question?
I do, and first let me comment on what an excellent presentation this is. I've learned so much about Delta Bison and the politics and the finances involved in the last 15 minutes. It's been really good information. But on the financial side, did I hear correctly there's 40,000 applications for Delta Bison tags, or is that 40,000 people or 40,000 individual, you know, permit applications it could come from?
That's 40,000 tickets in the hat. So, you know, with the new system where you can apply multiple times, that's hard to differentiate that. We tried last year, and it's still, like, close to 30,000 individuals. But the last three or four years, it's been 40 to 45,000 tickets in the hat for Delta Bison.
Times $10.
So that's $400,000 matched it four times. That's 1.6 million generated simply for, you know, by hunters applying to hunt these bison. If my math is correct, it just seems crazy to me that only 90,000 of that can be found to actually, you know, support.
And that's, you know, the Delta community, you know, said that same thing, and, you know, and that's part of why they put this grant together. They feel like I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, but they basically said without saying it that they were owed this, because what he just said, all this money, and we're only putting 90,000. But it's weird, you know, state government is politics, like, there's a spending authority, like, we're even worried with this, we found some loopholes, but if we get, you know, $4 million to put towards the bison range restoration in Delta, is that going to go towards the spending authority, you know, with fish and game? And we found some loopholes, but typically it would. So, you know, and there's a lot of other projects in the region too. So, yeah, whatever reason, the 90,000 is what we've been getting, and now there's going to be 4 million going toward it.
And I want to correct what I said earlier. That money wasn't going to go straight to the bison range, but it was understood that increasing it, the bison range would get what they would need for operations.
Yeah. But that's...
the money came in. It went to the general fund so that there was a PR dollars, and then the bison range would get what they needed for model.
That's a hard one, because you got the actual, you know, the 90,000, but then like salaries. So you can cut 440,000, do the math, it's whatever million. But stuff like salary, you can't match that with PR. So like the staff needs to get paid before the match happens. You're not actually matching $440,000. So.
I see,
and I'm not advocating for this. This is Mike Kramer, and just one follow-up. Has there ever been a compensation program for the farmers for crop damage done by bison?
No, and that'd be out of Board of Game purview. That'd be legislation. And what we've learned from looking into that, that's not a great idea from other states when they've done it. You know, what happened with the best heart of intentions, you know, if you grow 200 acres of whatever in Montana, you know, you're entitled to these elk permits. And, you know, now it's all the way down to like 10 acre hobby farmer and you get your two elk permits, which you can give to somebody.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, the writing's on the wall. And you'd have people from Anchorage and whatever buying these little pieces of land so they got their bison permit. So, I don't think.
No, I wasn't advocating for payments or depredation hunts, but if, you know, payments were made, it would be on a per-issue basis. The farmer would say, hey, the bison tore up 10 acres of my field.
Yeah.
You know, it's already been harvested. How much? All right.
Well, we need subsidized the fencing.
The fencing was subsidized, and I would argue, you know, I've heard crop insurance doesn't cover that kind of thing. I would argue whatever. If there was any compensation, I would argue it should come from Division of Ag, not Fishing Game. We manage wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. Private property is getting damaged. And there was actually a bill about that, not that, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And, you know, that guy, a guy from Palmer got on the phone, well, how about the damage to my hay from the moose? And then a commercial fisherman got on the phone, or are you going to pay for my nets that get damaged from seals and whatever? And that killed the whole thing. So.
Jennifer, do you have a question?
Yeah, I put that in the chat. Thanks. This is Jen Newhouse. I'm online and I've been listening to the whole thing. You know, you've got some concerns about the funding sources and that perpetually the state has been reluctant to pursue the money that's in the farm bill each year for this. They had some discussions with that back in 2009 with a former deputy commissioner that thought we should use PR funds for fences. And some of this compensation funds that Mike had brought up, that actually came up in the early 2000s when one of the progeny of a large potato farmer moved up and joined the Delta Chamber of Commerce and was already looking at ways to get paid not to grow potatoes. But I want to advocate that we are looking into the farm bill and keeping our PR dollars for what is PR. Really, even that includes trying to lure bison away from farms. There's money in the farm bill. We don't use it. And there's so many projects statewide that we need those PR funds for. But I'm really encouraging the three departments to work together with Ag and pursue that a little more heartily. Thanks.
Any other questions?
Very concerned with all this intention. So a lot of the hunters do harvest. I should say a good number of them pay trespass fees to the farmer when they get north of the highway. Is there any concern that if intention gets so bad that either those trespass fees will be so astronomical that the hunters get deterred and that's their way of kind of stomping their feet and saying, hey, listen to us now, because we don't like the way things are being managed. You know, obviously if they're south of the highway, it's not a big deal, but is that a point of concern?
So it's private land. They can do what they want. If they want to charge some astronomical amount of money, I guess they're entitled to do that. But surprising to me, you know, the fees, they've changed through the years. First off, you used to be able to go pretty much wherever you wanted, even for things like, you know, crane and goose hunting, and now it's, you know, we've been really constricted. And then they said, you know, a little bit of fees, and then it got to 500, which people were willing to pay. But, you know,
2,000 now.
But now there's several farmers, or two for sure, that are charging $2,000. And I thought that would deter people, not people are willing to pay that still. So this one farmer in particular, last year, things were really screwed up. We had to curtail the hunt up. We lost those places. And, you know, so they only had a weak season. And so you had to hunt them where they were at versus now you got 6 months, just wait them out and then move on to the bison range and hunt for free. But then you had to hunt wherever they were. So you had people lined up on the highway or on the gravel road in front of this place because you only allowed one person on at a time, one party. And he sold something like 20 to 25 hunts at $2,000 a piece. So he made a pretty good chunk of change for just trespass fees. And whether he agree with it or not, that's his, you know, his right.
Any other questions? Just one. What would it take to get a permit?
I'm not sure I'd be in favor of that. At least not right now. Then we get weird things that we got to live with for 20 years. So I just would like to see I'd like to see it managed like any other species. We come to these meetings, we present the data, you know, the ACs advise us. But why has it got to be special? I don't see that. It's always been special because the farmers, you know, want their way. And they do have a loud voice, but, you know, I'm hoping with spending $4 million on everybody's money that the other people will have a loud voice now too.
Any other questions? Bob, thank you very much for coming down.
Yeah.
We went there last week.
Yeah.
I want you to come down.
Thank you guys. Yep.
Go ahead and introduce yourself, Dave.
Yeah, my name is Dave Horning, and I have a quick question for Tony. What's the department's involvement with the Mercury Dome wind farm project? Are you working on that at all, or what do you see?
I've only seen some preliminary potential sites. So the department has commented on some of it, but that's it. It hasn't been very in-depth at all. I've heard more on the outside than I have.
And I know I'm not on the agenda, but I just attended the Big Game Commercial Services Board meeting. I know Mark was listening also. And I'm the Board of Game representative that's on that board. And statutorily, you have to have a game board member on Big Game Commercial Services Board. And so they actually came up with like seven things in the wish list of what they're working on. That would be important for you folks to hear what the guides and the guide board and the transporters and those folks are wanting to do in the future. And if you got a couple, I don't take a minute to do this. And I know some of them pretty in depth, and you can talk about that at another time. But would that be okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
Again, I sat on the board. I'm actually a member of the board, and I go vote and ask questions and so on and so forth on the guide board. Of course, the number one thing that they're worrying about right now is that board is going to sunset this spring. And their main goal is to get the board back in place again. They had a legislative audit and it went well. And they don't see any problem with it being reinstated again for the next number of years it's going to take. But they do want to add an executive assistant, somewhere for those, the lady on the board of game, you know, Christy Kibbles. They don't have a full-time assistant to do their board work like Board of Game does. The assistant that's working with them is split between the Marine Pilots Board and the Big Game Services Board. So that's going to be placed probably in the sunset package for this person so they have their own full-time assistant. They can keep due diligence to that board. And then after that, the next biggest thing they have on their agenda is coming up with a concession program for guides on state land. And as you know, that right now there's no limit of number of guides that are on state land. If you could say 28 over here or 19D down there by McGrath, it's all state land. Anybody can go on there if you're a registered guide and have that area under your license. So they're looking at putting in on getting a concession program in state instituted so that they can kind of work similar to how the federal government's doing now, kind of similar to how we did prior to the ASAP decision before that went. So that's their next biggest movement. We also want to talk about the adding two more positions to the board, the guide board. They want to have two additional guides, so make that number from 9 to 11. Because there's quite a bit of work involved with regulations and testing, both unit testing and guidelines testing, and other things that guides have, you know, work and knowledge of. And they need to spread some of this, this work out among other individuals. So they're talking about doing that. They're also talking about, changing the regulations to make transporters a natural person. Right now, transporter is just a license, so it's not a natural person. And so there's some issues dealing with that. So if you were to pull up a transporter license, that person then could just go back and get another license on a different name. So it's not attached to him if there's something wrong, as it would be for a guide or somebody else, if that makes sense. You also want to provide for survivorship and for emergency situations in regulation on how they could handle what happens if somebody was to pass away, if there is your guide, you know, his businesses, his client, that type of thing. And also, emergency, let's just say, the guide just can't do his job because maybe a sickness in the family or something else similar to that. You want to try to get that regulation right now, it's not, and that's pretty important for the group. You also want to work on updating the suspension triggers. What I mean by that is there's a matrix right now that if a guide is convicted in court, and let's say it's a $3,000 fine, that then triggers a lighter fashion. And they want to try to make that the $3,000 or whatever the number is in the matrix needs to be updated to the current values and what a dollar's worth today. These triggers are pretty old. They want to update that. They also want to have some type of oversight on booking agents and hunt planners. Right now, there's not any of that oversight. And there's quite a bit of issue with, you know, with booking agents and hunt planners in the guiding industry and how they operate. They also want to kind of update the regulation process. Right now, it takes a long time from when the board puts together a regulation, like the board of game, let's say. We'll have a little regulation. This goes to affect every first, you know, from maybe a mark. If a big game first service board, sometimes that's up to a year long. They want to try to streamline that and try to get that so it happens quicker. We also want to have, right now there's a marine transporter group and there's an air transit, the aviation transport, city air taxis. They're looking at possibly licensing those or separating that group into two different groups instead of just over one, you know, being covered by one set of regulations. And then they're also looking at continuing education among the guides. They want to try to implement more education, more required education, and kind of similar to what, say, nursing or PA, physician's assistants do, to maintain their license, they have to, you know, continue their education process. But anyway, I just thought that'd be interesting for you folks to know what the writing industry is doing, and what their wish list is here in the next few years. And again, the most important thing is getting that sunset pass, so they're still in business, and then the concessions for state land. Okay.
Anybody
got any
questions for Dave? We could have a whole nother meeting, Dave, on the Big Game Commercial Services Board and what they're doing. And I just wanted to bring up this guide concession program. That this started in 2008 with an Alaska Professional Hunters Association request for $200,000 from the Palin administration because unlimited guides were causing biological harm to our wildlife populations, restrictive draw hunts for other people. So this has been going on for well over about 15 years now,
And the only solution the Board of Game and the Guide Board has chosen to fix this problem is this guide concession program that the legislature did not approve and never made it out of committee, and it's really dead in the water right now, and they're pushing it. And I just want to let you all know that when I testified at the meeting last week, what I told the Guide Board was, I'd rather see you, if you're going to go to the legislature this next session and push for legislation to fix these problems, I'd rather have you open up the Title VIII statutes to try to fix what you told me you couldn't fix. They have told me they don't have the authority to limit guides on state land. They can't fix those problems. And so what I ask them is go and open up Title VIII so you have the authority to limit guides in the areas where you know there are too many. And also, the most important thing is to conjoin this with DNR, because right now, what's happening, DNR, so when the guide asks for a lease, DNR can't say, you're 100 yards from Coke Wallace, and we have to refuse your LAS agreement. They can't do that. There's nothing in DNR statutes that allows them to tell one guide you can't be 100 yards from another guide. And that's happening. Guys are getting permits to operate camps on the same airstrip as other guys. Anyway, so there's a lot other things that that board can do to fix these problems and continue to push for a guide concession. And the main thing about this, it never was a problem of too many guys. It's a problem of the Board of Game allowing unlimited non-resident hunting opportunity for where you're required to have a guide. So that's the really the big problem. It's a Board of Game issue, really, that the Board of Game needs to fix instead of trying to hand this off on this guide concession program. And that's all I'm going to say for now.
Again, those are the seven or eight that they were looking at. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you, Dave, on the board. You're gonna find out a lot, I'm sure.
Thanks, Dave.
Let me
put that in the comments. Is there any other public comments? Anybody else?
I just got an update on the price.
Old business?
Can I just bring up one more thing? I was asked by, the wildlife troopers, we're not going to be here tonight, but Justin just wanted me to pass on that they have been regularly out there monitoring the Cease Highway. They haven't had any caribou violations. They've had some federal harvests, but that's all legal. And the other thing he wanted me to tell you was that they are going out on trap lines. You know, they are monitoring trap lines just to make sure, you know, everything's kosher in case there's any conflicts with other trappers. So if you see troopers out there on your trap line, you know, they're out there doing their job, so don't get down on them. That's all I had from AWC.
Moving on to new business, Game and Trap Subcommittee updates. Mark, that's you.
So, does everybody have a copy of the minutes from the Game Trap Subcommittee meeting? There's a few of these. Are we going to do this now? Is vote on them, John?
Yeah.
Or, go ahead, John.
Can we have a break before we start?
Yeah.
I'll take a 10-minute break. We'll be back at
18.5. Demon Subtext?
Yeah. Five behind you.
That was a good idea to take a break.
Yeah, better if you wear a little
John.
Bob is doing a big thing.
Okay. Are we off record? Yes, it's green light, like this one here. Put it in the there you go.
That's why they have a chest. Yeah, they work a lot harder.
Yeah, I got it on. Great. Use it on now.
The dog, which means he was going to. We're back.
Are we back, Kyle?
Alright. Okay. So does everybody have a copy of the game subcommittee meeting? Because we're going to go over a few proposals. So I'm just going to go over the ones that we're going to come in. So any of the ones that has a little asterisk and it's bold says full AC, those are the ones that we wanted to bring before the full AC. I just want to start with number one. So as you guys all know, we have typically opposed any new archery-only hunts, which is what this proposal asks for in Unit 23 and 26, but when it opens up again, you know, bow only. So we have supported that with an amendment that if they do open it to include all weapons, and if they're concerned about over-harvest, we support a registration hunt with a quota. So let's leave it at that. So the other ones we wanted to bring up, so these are from the Western Arctic Herd Working Group. And this one is just for all the units, basically, instead of some of the other proposals asked for just Unit 23. So we've typically supported the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group, and what they're proposing is to reduce the bag limits throughout the Western Arctic Herd's range. 4 caribou per year, only one of which may be a cow. And we had the subcommittee has supported it, but with the caveat that the next proposal, number 3, asks to completely eliminate non-resident hunting. And we're not sure how we feel about that aspect of it. So we wanted to bring this up to the full AC. I think it's likely that we're going to support the lowering of the bag limit, especially the taking of cows needs to be reduced. And I think that's for this to come from the Western Arctic Working Group, to actually go from 5 per day to 4 per year only once, it's a pretty significant step for them, which is why I think they put it in the Proposal 3 that if we're going to bear this brunt of restrictions, we have to eliminate non-residents. But John Wisniewski is representing us at the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group. He called me earlier today. Alex Hansen, who is the area biologist now, also Jim Dow was there, had mentioned that there's only 100 caribou taken by non-residents every year, and it's just totally insignificant, and basically there's no real reason to eliminate non-resident hunting. So that's why we wanted to bring this before the AC and take a vote. So they do. So I just tell you from my resident hunter's Alaska perspective, when I've gone to Kotzebue and know what we have recommended to them every single time is to stop using the federal subsistence board, because the federal subsistence board can only eliminate non-federally qualified users, which is somebody from Munich, Germany, and somebody from Fairbanks. So we have asked them to at least go through the Board of Game, and if they wanted to keep locals that have moved out of the area, which is a problem because a lot of people have moved out of these areas for jobs or whatever, and they can't come home but they're not legally now. So they've done that, but now we have to decide, you know, if we want to, which one of these. So I would like to take a vote on Proposal 2, and I'll just ask for unanimous consent if there's no objections to lowering the bag limit to 4 per year, only one of them is fake, which may be a cow across the range of the Western Arctic Herd. And if there's no objections, then that will be our recommendation. So now let's take Proposal 3, which is to eliminate non-residents. And it came up at the meeting today that they're demanding pretty much that both of these proposals pass. They don't want 2 to pass without 3 to restrict, to eliminate non-resident funding. So
That's the wishes of the Western Arctic Caribou Hoof Working Group, which we have typically supported in the past. But I don't think, this is why we brought this, I don't think the AC is going to vote to eliminate non-resident hunting up there. So I don't know if we have unanimous consent there. So I'll just throw it around the room, some thoughts here. Right.
One of the problems I think for the non-resident takes such a low amount, I don't know if it's worth it.
Okay. They're restricted to bull only as well.
Say that again?
There's a single bag limit, one caribou bull only right now?
Yeah.
And that's what, 100?
That's what they said today at the meeting, was that about 100 caribou were taken by non-residents. Not resident, non-locals, but by non-residents.
Okay.
Yeah, I see 100 caribou out of 164,000 is
nothing.
And probably procure bulls and whatnot, I'm guessing they're going to be harvested.
Quite a bit of transporter activity if they're, you know, associated with this. Money comes into the villages, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess the point they were making is that, I mean, they are going from Firebirds. I mean, it is a pretty significant, you know, thing for them to request to lower the bag on that. And their thinking is that if we're going to do this, then we should make non-residents bear the brunt of this restriction. So is anybody going to vote yes on that one? If not, we should have to get our consent.
Mark?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Gail. Yeah, the only comment I would have is that by lowering the bag limit in Prop 2, then that will discourage non-resident hunters just by itself.
No. Hunts are already booked. So people are booked a couple of years out already, and they've already had to deal with the federal closure.
I only know from my own family experience. I do have family that has hunted up there from Wisconsin, and they're not going to because of the predicted bag limit reduction.
Yeah. I think that's probably fairly uncommon. Yeah.
And some residents are already restricted to one caribou.
Yes. Yellow, Mike, you're online still. I'm not sure if Mike is still with us. We'll see now.
Mike Kramer, are you still there?
I don't see him.
I am here, yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're on a different line. Mike, you got any thoughts on this? Like, you're probably going to be with the rest of us and not support the elimination of non-residents?
I'm sorry, Mark. I just recently joined. I didn't hear the full discussion. Was this what we discussed at the subcommittee meeting?
Yes, the ones we brought before the full AC. So number two, we're going to support to lower the bag limit to 4 caribou per year, only one of which may be a cow. And so now we're on proposal 3 from the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group that would completely eliminate the non-resident component.
And did we clarify that what they mean by non-residents are non-residents of the state of Alaska or non-locals?
No, these are non-residents, not non-locals. It is true that when I was up there, and it shocked me the first time, because they keep using the word non-resident, but they actually mean non-locals by that. But we did clarify this, that it's in the language, they mean non-resident out-of-state hunters.
And again, I apologize. I didn't hear the discussion, but you're now voting on whether to support that proposal to eliminate all non-resident hunting.
Yes, I don't think we have anybody here that's going to support that, so that's why I threw it out to you online just to make sure you're on the same page.
I am. Yes, thanks, Mark.
Go ahead, Chuck.
It's kind of like. Off the 5 caribou limit was
for non-residents too. Because she remembered, she said, reduce them to four would probably,
yeah, so Gail, just to clarify that, yeah. Proposal two is only to lower the bag limit for resident hunters.
Non-residents come out and pay a water share.
Right.
Anyway.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, thanks for the clarification. Yeah.
So dispute along, I would just ask for unanimous consent. If anybody has an objection to opposing this proposal, which is the action we're going to take, speak up now. And if not, that will be the action of the board will be to oppose it, so the committee to oppose it. Okay? All right. We are opposing that proposal, and I will, do we want to have any rationale? The 100 caribou per year take care of insignificant?
I would just add that it's not a significant number.
So John did tell me that they did vote to support 2 and 3 today, the group. I don't know how John votes, but that was their vote. Okay. So if we move down, so as you can see, this is out of our area, so we have TNAs. Most all of these. So the next one to come up would be, which number is that? 16. So proposal 16. And Jeff had some concerns at the meeting of this. So this is to, extend the season for wolves. What was that? End of April? Yeah, end of April 30th. Okay. So, I will note that the department, I just read through the ANRs today, and they're out, the department and office, and the department did support this proposal. So I don't know if this alleviates some of the concerns some of us had on denning, hide not being prime, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah. Talk to Randy
about this proposal.
Yeah, and I think at the subcommittee meeting we talked about there was some rationale about people needing snares more often in March time frame because they could still keep it working. The fur was prime at that point. I brought it up to our board of directors and we're kind of on the thing like more opportunity. We're all for it. The high creation. So ATA would be on board with it.
And that's what the department said in their comments, that it allowed more opportunity. So I will ask for unanimous consent if there's no objections to support Proposal 16. And if there's no objections so passed, we will support. And if anybody has anything that we haven't commented on or we TNA'd or any of these and they want to bring it up for us, speak up. So, all right, the next one. There's Proposal 20. Change the bag limit for Tier 2 musk-ox hunts in Unit 22 to 1 musk-ox every 3 years. So I have a little bit of information from this. I know the proposer, Jacob Mannix. And let me just, why he proposed this. So there are some people that have moved to Nome that have been there 10, 15 years. And they're also applying for these Tier 2 permits. And they haven't been able to get them because the people in Nome for 40 years or 30 years, they meet the criteria a lot better. So the rationale of this proposal was to separate it up every 2 years to allow the people that aren't getting the tier permit to get those on that off year. It was recently opposed by the Nome Advisory Committee, just to let you know that. So, obviously, they don't support it for public because a lot of them have been there for a long time and they want to keep getting the permits. And they are getting the permits every year, most of those people. So that's what this is about. And that's why we're bringing this to the 4-H. And it's an allocation thing, so the department is neutral on it. Any discussion on this one? I mean, personally, I think it makes sense. I mean, if your system is complicated, but it really is cutting out some people who have been there for 10 or 15 years from getting a permit. And I'm inclined to support it. I don't think it has a chance of passing, but I'm inclined to support it just to give opportunity for those people, you know, under the tier system that are locked out of it because of the criteria.
Mark, this is Mike Kramer.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm inclined to support it as well. I remember years ago when the Neltina permit was tier two, and people referred to it as a lying contest, and there was much discontent with, you know, all the permits, you know, for several years. But, you know, we had lower quotas all going to the people that could claim, you know, 40, 50, 60 years of hunting that herd, and no one else got the tags. And, you know, the same people would get the tags every year. You know, and what it came down to was your longevity, basically. And, you know, I don't think that should be the end-all, be-all for, you know, being allowed the opportunity to hunt a subsistence resource near your home community. And I think it strikes a good balance that looks at a loop there for, you know, it's still going to be your tier two scoring, but, you know, it's not the same group of people getting it every year. If that indeed is the case, which I trust your research is, or your contacts there have demonstrated.
Any other discussion?
Mark?
Yeah, go ahead, Gail.
Thank you. Do we know the reason why the Nome AC opposed it, or is it just they wanted the status quo?
I talked to my son. He's with the Nome now, and all I heard was that they opposed it, so I don't know why. I just took it to that a lot of the AC members are the people that are getting this here from it, so can't tell you.
I'm going to abstain on this, and I'll show you why. I know it's going to be brought up tomorrow morning from the Nome area, and I don't know what the background is. And I also feel, I agree with Mike Kramer and yourself, but I also feel I don't know the full story, so I just want to put it on the record. I'll stay on that phone.
Sure.
Okay.
You know,
the
developer
tags
that are applied for every year?
Yeah, I think I thought it was about 10 permits. I don't have the number. We'd have to look it up. It's not very many permits. It should be in the supplement, I think. Yeah,
Said 22 permit?
Yeah, 22. Yeah. So I've got 22A has 8 permits, 22B has 8, 22C out of Nome 15, and InterNome has 15. So it looks like we're talking about 30 permits here. Yeah, they just have 22, so it doesn't list just 22A or B.
I would move to support proposal 20.
Need a second? The motion's on the table to support. Why don't we go ahead and take a vote? Everyone in favor, raise your hand. Austin, are you raising your hand? I can't tell.
I'm digging it.
I know. Okay. Are you supporting?
I'm supporting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Who opposed?
Who opposed?
Yeah. 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 Okay. So, okay. One extension. Okay. So moving on. What else do we have? before the fully see. So let's go down to 36. That looks like 35. So these are the, okay, 35. Or no. 36, I'm sorry. Okay, so these are the same proposals as the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group, but just for Unit 23. So we're obviously going to support 36 because we have supported Proposal 2, which was to reduce the bag limit to 4 caribou per year, only one of us be a cow. So 36 we support. And it looks like 37, we are, let's see, 37 is the same proposal. We support that. And it's 38 to close all non-resident caribou herding units. 23, and since we have opposed that, I'm assuming we are going to oppose it for just unit 23. I'll ask for unanimous consent on that.
Depending on us, I think.
Okay. Okay, so these other ones with the asterisks are 39. Lengthened brown bear hunting season. So when we discussed this, we wanted the department to hear us because we didn't know what the bear population was doing and if the department supported it. So on 39, the department does support it. 40 is very similar. So 39, lengthened the brown bear hunting season, 23 for residents to no closed season. And I'm kind of surprised the department supported it, but they did. So based on the department recommendations, we were going to support it if they did. So is everybody okay with that? Support. And number 40, lengthen the brown grizzly bear hunting season for residents to year-round, same proposal. It's also supported by the department. So we can support that. I think there's just a couple more. 41, same thing. Department supports at length in the brown grizzly bear hunting season for residents to all year long. Same proposals. And that's all that we have flagged for the full AC. So you guys want to go over any of these other ones. If you don't agree with the game trap subcommittee, let us know now. Otherwise, this is going to be a recommendation to the board. We're all good? All right. That's it for that. And thanks everybody for coming to that meeting. We have quite a few.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah. So, let's see what works for everybody. So the next game prep meeting will be going over the Region 3 proposals. They aren't due until March. So I'm wondering if we want to wait. And what do you think? Let's set a meeting for January. Everybody look at your calendars. And
our meeting will be in your mind.
Okay. You don't need to approve them until February, so it could be after the next meeting. So the next meeting is January 10th, OAC. Let's see if my name is later.
January
22nd, a Monday.
Oh, yes.
No, no, on
here? Oh, yeah. Great.
One day.
Over
here. When is MLK Day? That's going to show from 15th, Monday.
Yep.
Are you in Hawaii?
For the 22nd?
I'm in Hawaii from the 12th to the 21st.
Jeez, good deal. Well, you probably don't want to meet the day after you get back.
No, I don't care. We can meet the day after.
How is Monday the 22nd work? Everybody, Austin, we're great too. Yep. No. Well, do we?
Yeah, we know we need 5:30. I forgot where we're meeting a little earlier.
Can we do 5:30?
5:30 is better for people that are getting off work. They don't start until
5:30. Okay, let's do 6 then.
I will be off by 5:30.
Let's do 5:30. It makes it easier for like John who's getting off work and not having to drive back to Esther. All right, so 5:30. Kyle, can we do it at the Fish and Game office?
Yeah,
that's correct. Okay, so 5:30 at the Fish and Game conference room. So there's quite a lot of those proposals, so I don't know. I mean, we'll have to get ahead of it. Everybody look at the book and everything, but, I mean, we'll be there several hours unless we want to break it up into two. So if we find we can't go to them all, we'll just schedule another. But that has to be public notice, right, Kyle?
Yeah.
10 days? Yeah. Okay.
Gail?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we're ready for your subcommittee report.
Okay, thank you very much. And I apologize, I couldn't be there tonight. My plow guy can't come till tomorrow, and I'm totally snowed in. So we met, the fishery subcommittee met on Monday night. We had a pretty lively discussion. Most of it was centered around the action taken at the Lower Cook Inlet Board meeting last week. And we had one proposal at that meeting, proposal number 43, which was to reduce the egg production at Tutka Bay Hatchery in Cook Inlet, and that will not be deliberated on until the Upper Cook Inlet meeting in February. And I want to read a statement here. All of us on the AC understand this, but mainly this is for the public record. The reason that we are doing these proposals for hatchery egg reduction is that there's a lot of evidence over production of pink salmon contributing to the decline of all wild salmon stocks. There's no other venue to create a public conversation about this, and the Board of Fish has authority to amend hatchery egg production. There is tremendous support over the entire AYK to reduce hatchery production as part of efforts to reduce all human-affected impacts on salmon. So this is one of the ways that we can help anadromous fish, salmon particularly. So what happened on 43 is that's going to be deliberated in February, and we will be preparing our testimony accordingly. And then the big action came within the last 20 minutes of the board meeting on December 1st, on a Friday afternoon, very late. And I wasn't paying attention to that because I was on another project, and I got a call and said they're talking about proposal number 59. So I jumped on the meeting, and in a very short period of time, the upshot was that four members of the board voted to remove proposal 59, which was egg reduction for the Katoi Bay Hatchery, to remove it from the Kodiak proposal book. Kodiak meeting is coming up in January, and to just remove it completely. It was a kind of a torturous argument that they had to go through on this, and I won't go into detail on it unless you have questions. I did do a complete transcript of the board meeting. The upshot is that this is an unnoticed action, and they were warned by the board general counsel that it was likely to have some consequences, and I can read his statement if you want, but it was rather egregious, and it was unnoticed. They had to change their reasoning for the action a couple of times when confronted with some evidence. So, and we weren't there to defend it, obviously. So now we are left. There were two members, by the way, who strongly objected, and that was Mark Carlson Von Dort and Stan Zuray. And one member was absent for that vote, so it was a 4-2 vote. It likely violated the Administrative Procedures Act and the Open Meetings Act. So we have a lot of research to do. And I think our reaction to this is going to be measured and well-researched and will be in steps. So I think the first step I would like to make is to write a letter to the governor and commissioner requesting clarification, legal clarification on the action, and to ask to reinstate Prop 59 into the Upper Cook Inlet meeting, because there's no time to have that action at the between now and that Kodiak meeting. I mean, it's off the books right now. So I'm going to ask the AC to support us in writing that letter. I don't have a draft of that now, and what we can do is, if you want to support that action, then we'll draft it, we'll circulate it among members, and but I just want to get started on it. Just to also, if what we're really trying to do with all of these hatchery proposals, because we've been getting a lot of grief from the board about certain board members, not all of them, about these repetitive proposals coming in, and they feel like it's an attack on hatcheries. That's not what we're doing at all. And we keep saying that. What we're trying to do is to have a public conversation on this. And there's no other venue but the Board of Fish at this moment. So they're really trying to shut us down from having that conversation. And I don't know if you all caught it. I think I sent it around. Dr. Peter Wesley from the university had an op-ed in the Anchorage Daily News just a couple of days ago on this very topic, and supporting the concept of going after a public hearing process, a review process, so to speak, of where the hatcheries have been, because we haven't had really any real review of the hatchery process since 1992, when there was a legislative review. So this is where we are. It is likely an illegal action, but that has to be up to the state to determine. And I would like to a motion from someone, if we can, to support us writing a letter to that effect.
I got a question first. Dale, can you explain to the committee? I understand the executive director of the board for the board support was at your meeting. Can you explain to the committee why the board deleted our proposal?
Well, it was quite a, like I said, it was a torturous process. Their intent was to remove it from the Kodiak book, but they had to go through a lot of gyrations to get there. And the first one was that the board support, when they were vetting the proposals and putting them in proposal books, it inadvertently they took off the lettering of Katoy Bay Hatchery. And so it was put in the Kodiak proposal book as a statewide proposal. So the first objection that the proposer of the motion had was that it was a statewide issue and it didn't belong in Kodiak, but it was very clearly for the Katoy Bay. And then, so the board support executive director got up to the board and explained very clearly that it was an error on their part. They're going to correct that error. They just had done that, and it would be a noticed correction. So then the next objection that the proposer had to the proposal is that it was not citing the correct regulation for the action. Well, the reason is because we were trying to go after an allocation plan to reduce the egg production at Katoy Bay, and Katoy Bay doesn't have an allocation plan. I suspect that comes through their CSP, which is the Comprehensive Salmon Plan process, but it is noted. It's been noticed in all of their enhancement reports, annual enhanced reports, that they have this permitting for 215 million eggs, and they've had it for, I don't know, 25, 30 years. I really don't know. And Nancy, you're on here now. Did you want to talk to that very briefly?
Not really sure. That's their permanent capacity, but I think they're, you know, probably collecting something like 150 million eggs, which is still humongous. You know, it's a lot of eggs to have. So
I believe it's I believe it's 215 million if it in the enhancement plan.
Yeah, that's the permanent capacity.
And yeah, that is Mara, the capacity, right? Correct.
Mara at that meeting, the one thing she did ask a number of times was, "Where's the assessment of these hatcheries?" And no one seemed to have an answer. So, you know, I think this would be really good to just be able to understand, like, where is the handle to kind of steer this hatchery issue? Because spread division no longer exists, of course. So now it's, you know, it's just a matter of, it's kind of flapping in the wind out there. So it'd be nice to see if we can somehow see if there's a structure to this assessment.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you for that. Does that answer your question, Mark?
Yes. And one more thing. So did Aaron, the Department of Law attorney attached to the board, did he say that their action was not legal during the meeting, or what were his comments again?
I'm going to read you verbatim from the transcript. It's a very short little paragraph for his comments. And he said, he had a couple of times that he addressed the board, but the last one was, "I want to clarify that the proposal as submitted was proper. It is the direction of the Department of Law to this board for decades, with his emphasis, that the board has authority pursuant to its statutory authority under 16.10.440B to amend the terms of permits. That's what this proposal sought to do. The Department of Law would not say, here's something that the board statute says the board can do, but we're not going to do it to let it into the proposal book. We're not going to do that. This conversation about the proposal should be had at Kodiak, where the proposal is noted for. I don't know what procedural mechanism there is to remove it from the meeting here, and it has been submitted properly. Now, there was an administrative error, and that has been rectified, but I don't know what administrative procedure there is to remove it here so that it wouldn't likely generate more issues than having it addressed at the Kodiak meeting. So I would have concerns with removing it here after people have presumably assumed they have the ability to debate it in Kodiak." And those were his comments.
And so a letter is our only recourse then? A letter is our only recourse really to appeal this?
I think we're going to do this in steps, Mark. We need some clarification from how the state is. We may not get it. I don't know. But I think we're going to have to address this in steps. And okay. I would not see that as our only recourse, no.
This AC is what I've submitted.
Yeah. It's our proposal 59, yeah. So there's a motion. Is there a motion on the table, I think? Did we have a second? Second, Lance? To support an AC letter, Gail, is that what we're voting on?
That is correct. Thank you.
Unanimous consent.
No objections.
No moves. So
moved. You'll pass that on to all of us, Gail, before you send it?
Yeah, before it gets sent, obviously we'll send it around to members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item is related, and it's a relatively new item that was brought to our attention just last week. And it's sort of a routine procedure where hatcheries apply for their licensing. And we do have this is for the DIPAC net pen increase. And we're concerned about that. They're asking for an increase so they can have open net pens for a year rather than the current time period they have. We do have a representative from DIPAC. Katie, are you willing to speak to that increase and what that is really all about?
Yeah, I'm happy to. We lost a storage facility for our frames for the net pens due to a glacial outburst flood in the Mendenhall River, and some land was taken out that helped us with our over off-season storage of neck pens. So we currently don't have a place to put them when they aren't in use. So this is just amending that permit to allow us to store them there, but it doesn't change when we have fish in them. It's just a storage site.
Okay, we were confused by the language in the request. Let me read that for everybody. It's very brief. And that is, Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, has received an amendment application from Douglas Island Pink and Chum DIPAC to change the permit terms of their existing net pen array from seasonal moorage to year-round moorage and use. The array consists of 12 40-by-40 net pens, a work float barge for the storage of fish feed and for crew quarters, and an associated mooring system of two buoys. So it is your intent on this permit only to be used as storage and not to increase production? Is that what you're saying?
Correct, yes. Yeah, normally we move those pens and in the barge in the when they aren't in use just to have them out of the way. But we don't have a storage facility for them. Currently we're working on finding additional space, but right now we're just looking to have a place where we can store them year-round, but it doesn't change when we'll have fish in them. It doesn't change any capacities.
That's good to know. Thank you. I'm a little bit of a quandary here because we do have members who do want to write an objection to this, but that's the clarification we didn't have Monday night. We lost you at the very end. I know it was a long meeting and it wasn't that long, but I would have to talk with those members and see. I think we still need to go ahead and send in our comments in general about, what, so that other net pens aren't coming up that would be used for additional capacity. Does that make sense? And not to object to this on the basis that's used for storage. Does that make sense to you, Katie?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I looked at the permit the other day. The title of it is confusing, but, yeah, it's just to have a place where we can anchor those things up.
Okay. And on that basis, I don't think we would object, but I think we need to send in our general comments just for any future, just for the record for future, not really objecting to this proposal as is interpreted. So with that, I would ask the AC to give us permission to draft that letter. And again, that would go to members. We would do a lot of more research on it. We go to members before it got sent.
Is there a proposal number on that, Gail?
It's a permit request number, and that is LAS18770, DIPAC.
What does DIPAC stand for?
Douglas Island Pink and Chum. And Katie, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys are you're not part of the PNP hatchery system as such, you're private, separate, is that correct?
Oh, we are a private nonprofit hatchery program, but we are a non-regional association.
That's what I was after, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not an RAA, okay.
Correct.
Thank you. And because you're not an RAA, you don't assess an enhancement tax for any harvest, do you?
That's correct. Yeah, all the fish within our region would go to the regional association's tax.
Okay. So you are inside of another RAA?
Correct.
Okay. And you're inside, so that would be Northern Southeast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That makes sense, though.
I will make a motion that we support a letter on the permit request that Gail has mentioned.
Then second. Any objections? Okay.
So moved.
So moved, Dale.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, and the next, there are comments due for the Kodiak board meeting on December 26th. Because of the recent Board of Fish action, I'm not inclined to have any comments. I haven't had time to review any of the other proposals, and we've taken no action on them. And December 26th is coming right up. So I'm going to assume that unless there's objection that we are not going to be commenting on Kodiak proposals.
No objections.
And then at the Monday night meeting, Andy Gruska gave a brief but really important discussion on pike. And Andy, do you want to just briefly tell the AC what you talked about?
Sure. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure, just Gail requested some information about pike predation on salmon, and I guess the short story, as short as I can keep it here, is whilst pike do eat some salmon, that's for sure, they're not the driving force as a predator. Amongst all the predators, there's many, many predators. And then secondly is pike and salmon, at least in the interior, are not together in time and space that often. So usually like when the smolt, your juveniles head out to the ocean, they go out with the high muddy water in the spring, and they float out in mass, overwhelming any predators that are around, and pike are visual, so they don't see a lot of them sometimes. The other thing pike are doing is, at least if they're adults, they're in the backwaters and in the grasses and stuff and spawning at the same time. So that was kind of the take-home point, is that they are, you know, somewhat of a predator, but they're not a huge impact. They've been together for thousands of years here in the interior. The Matsu Valley is the one that kind of gets the big press, and there the salmon utilized, when pike weren't there, they're utilizing what we might refer to as great pike habitat. And that's where they're having a problem, really. So that's the short story.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. It's just a reminder all the time. You know, you and Klaus are always reminding us that there is a certain homeostasis here. The conversation kind of centered around, well, when salmon populations are so far down that these normal relationships might have more of an impact. And we did have quite a bit of discussion about avian impacts from seagulls and mergansers and other birds of prey, which might be in the same situation, that when the numbers are down, they have more of a impact because of the relationship. So does that make sense, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, there's some potential there, but you also have to remember, if they're not seeing as many salmon as they are seeing grayling, they're going to switch to the what they see the most of. So if they're seeing a lot more grayling than they are salmon, they'll key in, their eyes will key in on that. It's just one of those things where, you know, it's we're all talking about conjecture here, because nobody actually has, like, the actual data. Like, in 2003, this is what pike were eating, and in 2023, this is what they're eating. Nobody has that data to compare in the same location where salmon, you know, sometimes pass through where the pike are. So that's the hard part there, is trying to, like, say exactly what the effect is. We just know that salmon numbers are down, and so we think, well, any predator is a problem. You know, humans are a predator of salmon, and that's why quite often you're talking about some of the other aspects that,
right,
you know, the fisheries and such where humans are involved. So it's really going to be hard. You can't really do anything about pike. We can just think about pike, but we can't really do anything. They're throughout the whole drainage of the Yukon River system.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, that was a good report. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gail,
this is Mark. I just got a quick question for Andy, if you have it handy. Andy, what was the total harvest of the whitefish spear fishery?
Thanks for asking. Hold on just a moment. Let me bring that up. We had 642 harvested among 300 permits. So that average was 3.71 per permit, which is a little bit down from the past 2 years, but not as low as it has been in a couple instances. The participation was about average. We're at 58%. Usually we're right around 60.
And what was it, 1,000 was the max you wanted to see taken, Andy?
Yeah, that's the max harvest we'd like to see taken. You know, like I say, I've told you in the past, you know, if it ended up being, you know, 1,100 one year and 900 the next year, I'd consider that 1,000 average, right? So we're still not getting all the way up there as far as I'm concerned. You know, granted this year, maybe the harvest rate wasn't quite as good, but, you know, one time in the past 15 years, we hit 1,100 fish. A couple times, we've hit 900 fish harvested, and more often than not, we're in the 600 to 700 amount.
Any chance you're going to increase the number of permits again?
I will certainly be considering that. I wanted to let this run at least a couple years you know, we could just see what happens here. I didn't want it to be, you know, 1 year and, oh, is everything just fine? You give it a couple years and maybe we'll see something different. So I want to let it run at least 3 years. So this next year will be the third year at 300.
All right. Well, thanks. I'm going to blame you if I duplicate a permit next year.
Yes. We'll put you at the top of the list.
Blame the pike.
Yeah.
Okay, and the last thing, Andy, since you mentioned you might not be around in January, I think for the full AC meeting, we need to have a discussion on the stocking plan because
performance
are due at the end of January.
Sure, I will. Yeah, I will get be in contact with Klaus and April and Kelly, so we'll make sure we have it covered. Depending on what date it is that you actually have the meeting, I may or may not be there, so that's...
That is going to be the 10th of January.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can be there for that.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Okay. Thanks very much, Andy. Always appreciate your report. And
you're welcome.
He did send along some that we posted on the fisheries subcommittee meeting. Some papers from Eric Schoen from the university, which are really good. I recommend everybody read them if you get a chance. So then we've got the initial review of the Upper Cook Inlet proposal strategic plan for Prop 43 coming up at the January Fisheries Subcommittee meeting, which will be on January 8th. That's all I have at the moment. I know I'll have a lot more, but that's all I have now. And that's my report, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Gail. Moving on, we need to select a representative for the Board of Game Unit 19C Sheep Working Group.
So I wanted to make a couple comments before we do that. The last meeting that the three board members on the subcommittee had, they didn't really clarify. I had asked them to clarify whether someone who is a guide who is on an AC or someone like myself that represents an organization who is on an AC can be a member of the group. I was hoping they would clarify that that would not be allowed, but they didn't. So the Matanuska AC, I just want to let you all know this. I'm not going to ask to be on the sheep working group because I do represent RAC and I don't think that would be right, but the Matanuska AC had quite a deliberation at their last meeting. Dan Montgomery, who was a guide, wanted to be on the sheep working group. They ended up appointing Bob Castle, who is the resident Hunters of Alaska vice president, to be on that group with Dan Montgomery as an alternate. I'm fairly confident that I've been reaching out to Jerry Burnett, the chairman, to ask. They said they're not going to clarify this until the next meeting, either in late December or early January. So But what else I wanted to get from this group, so I wanted to make sure whoever we appoint on this group is going to represent what the AC wants. And we have voted on this before on some of the Resident Hunters Alaska proposals to put all non-residents on draw permits. And so I just want to make sure whoever we appoint to the group is going to the will of the AC on the group and what we want. So we might want to have a discussion on that after we appoint somebody. But I just wanted to make those comments ahead of time.
Do you have somebody who wants to volunteer?
I think we have several people. But
what are the requirements? Like, they have
you just have to be on the AC. So the other thing, I talked to Ryan Scott, so it looks like the commissioner is not going to fund what the Board of Dean wants. They're not going to fund a facilitator. They're not going to fund, you know, in-person meetings. The last I heard when I talked to Ryan Scott a couple days ago was that there will be no facilitator, and this is kind of going to be a Zoom thing. So it's looking kind of, I don't know, not like a real group with a facilitator, you know, that costs $60,000 and all that. The department just doesn't want to spend the money on a real type working group with a facilitator. So that's where we are right now. It could change, but we do need to, and again, so and at that last meeting, so at first they had said the McGrath AC is going to be on the group, and that we want to have someone from the Anchorage, the Fairbanks, and the Mac 2 AC on the group. And then at the very last minute of the meeting, Jerry Burnett has said that, well, it might not be all three of those ACs. It might be just one of those ACs who we choose to be on the working group. So we don't even know if the Fairbanks AC is going to be on the group. We don't know which AC will be on the group, or maybe all three ACs. They just left the whole thing sort of scrambled, you know, wide open. I thought at the time that they were looking at who the AC representative was going to be, and then they were going to say, okay, we're going to let this person to be on the group. But at this time, we don't know, even if our AC, but we do need to appoint somebody to represent. So I know I've heard interest from several of you guys here, or at least a few, so if you want to toss your name in the ring, toss your name in the ring, and we can do it.
Sounds like a boondog, so I don't want to. If it's going to be spoken here, just have a committee to make sure no support of the department. I don't want to be a part of it. It's going to jerk us around.
Well, the department is going to be there. They're not going to be a part of a voting member of the group. The department staff will be there to answer questions, you know, and probably Josh Pierce, the area biologist for 19C, you know, will be on the Zoom calls as well. So, I mean, the department will be involved. They just, you know, this is a lot of money for another cheap working group that I think leadership doesn't believe is, you know, worth spending a lot of money. We don't know anything. They left everything wide open. And so the other thing was, and so they put out a draft charge statement initially, okay? And something that Resident Hunters Alaska complained about was the draft charge statement said we want recommendations from this group by the March 2024 meeting. And even Jake Fletcher, a guy who's on the subcommittee, says that's we shouldn't rush things. We're not going to get any recommendations by the March meeting, but you can see where this whole thing is heading. They're wanting to push this through so these recommendations that come can give them an out for whatever they decide to do with this new. And the other thing that we complained about was if you want a cheap management, that should come from the department. I mean, this is something Wayne Heimer and I are totally in agreement with. Kind of rare, but it's like, if you want to come up with a new cheap management, that should come from department biologists and managers. That shouldn't come from a guy, the transporter, AC members, you know, I mean, what really can we do? The pie is really small. That's really what this is about. The pie is really small, and so they have to decide. Nobody likes that they eliminated the non-resident component. So Resident Hunter's Laugh has a proposal, and we're willing to open it again just like we have all along. We've never asked for a closure. We've just asked to limit non-residents to draw permits only with a limited allocation. So we have a proposal in now. Open it up again. Put non-residents on 10 permits. If the herd increases, you know, then we can move on. But and that seemed to be where the AC was at the last, you know, time we went over this, was the same thing as Rack had proposed. So
what's the objective of this commission?
And to come up with a new sheep management plan to recommend to the Board of Game for 4 months. So what's going to come out of this, and what I think, and I think Jack Rekoff had a great idea that it was an ACR that the board didn't accept. It was a split vote, and they were missing one member, so it was a tie. So because it was a tie, it got voted down. And that was to change the regulations, the FOCRO regulations, to make it so take away the age requirement completely. It's either full curl, double broom. That's it. That's the only legal sheep. There would be no age requirement whatsoever. So the positives of that is we really believe it would cut down on some of the counting range, you know, some of the annualized stuff going on, because there's so few full curl rams now that everybody is wanting to make that ram legal, and when they know it's not full curl, they're counting rings. And so we're having, you know, since the 9% sublegal harvest now, it's gone up in the last couple of years. So I see that that's one thing that they could recommend as a management plan, but that still doesn't take them away from the allocation issue.
Got it.
No, so as you know, when we had Trooper Rogers in here last year, and so I just brought this up to the Big Game Commercial Services Board. I showed him the stats from last year. I think it was 22, I forget. But 40% of the sublegal harvest is coming from non-resident guide hunters.
Wasn't the sublegal take this year like really small though? Wasn't it like 6 or 7?
Yeah, the sublegal take this year was 7.5%. Depends on when. They don't have everything now between all the areas. But yeah, it went down a little bit. But that guided take is still, was 33% this year instead of 40%. And that came up at the guide board meeting. They said, why are we, the investigator says, I have 81 open cases, guide violations, 81 open cases, okay. Highest he's had in a while. 50 of those are from contracting guys, register and master guys. No, but the board asked, why are this, it came up how many sublegal harvests there was and how much non-resident, why are we not seeing it? On the guy side, why are we? Well, that's because it doesn't get to them, because the violation typically goes on the hunter.
Yeah.
And they're the one that has to be taken away, and they're the one that has to come back into court. And the main reason you hire a guy really is just legality. I mean, that's one of them, but it's a weird issue with guys that it's not coming across the board that regulates them, and they're not getting dinged. Something happens to guys, to some guys.
That couldn't be part.
Yeah, that's a different board, though. The Board of Game can't do anything to guides. They don't have any authority. And I've brought this up at guide room meetings for 50 years. I've been going, there. Why are you doing this?
Who does have oversight? Guides.
The Big Game Commercial Services Board.
Ran by guides.
Yeah. Well, they want to take care of it. It's just that these don't. And the other thing that came up when I had... We asked, and I think it was Mike Potter who gave a presentation last year, of those that we had in the Fairbanks area last year when I got all that data finally, and I presented to the AC, 50% of the residents were sighted. Only, I think it was 10% of the non-resident guided hunters who were sighted. And Trooper Rogers and Potter, you know, when we asked them to explain, I mean, they really couldn't. There are all kinds of things. Whether the DA wants to prosecute, there was a thing where it came up in one case where a Fish and Game was there and said, can you absolutely, positively say that that sheep is 7 years old? And what Fish and Game could say is, no, we can't tell until we cut the horns longitudinally, like Joe Want shows, you know. Well, then it was like, well, if you can't say for sure, and no way this guy is going to say you can cut his sheep horns, case dismissed. So there's all kinds of things that come up.
maybe the guided hunter shot the wrong ram, you know, that happens, but they really couldn't explain why you were non-resident guided hunters with the insider than residents. So it's such a tough deal. But we do need someone we let on the group, regardless if it's a, we still need somebody to represent us and tell how we feel about this issue.
Yeah. Anybody else interested?
Mark, this is Mike Kramer. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
I served on the original sheep working group years ago, where we had a facilitator. It was a big in-person meeting there in Anchorage. I'd be happy to serve on this one regarding Unit 19 as well, and I would, you know, carry the committee's recommendations to that panel.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, we need to vote on the motion. I don't know if we need to vote that way. So I will make a motion to approve Mike Kramer as a representative of the 19CC working group with Levi and Llewellyn as an alternate.
Any objections?
Okay. So pass. No, no, we get into there, Mike.
You're in, Mike.
We want to hear all about it as it happens.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. And Mark, I missed it. If you said it, has a date been set or a general timeline? So they wanted.
We won't know until either later this month or most likely in early January. Yeah, I don't think we should go over that. The next game trap me. Those are in, let's see. I'm trying to figure out when the comments are due for the joint board meeting. Has anybody here looked over the joint board proposals? There's some from us. There's some interesting things that we're going to need to weigh in on. March 11th. Okay, so let's schedule that. We'll do that in February. Yeah, we'll schedule that.
Next schedule.
Yeah.
Select representative incentives for the board of page number 15 list February 23rd. March 7th.
Now, is Virgil, did we already talk to him? Gail, is Virgil going to that meeting?
Is it, this point, I think so. If you're talking about the Upper Trickland Inlet?
Yes.
Yes.
I think he's scheduled to do that. We're going to wait and see what happens here. So we can talk about it in January. We have plenty of time.
Okay.
But right now, he's playing today.
Okay, so we're going to set our next meeting date for January 10th, 2024. Anything else? Anybody have anything else?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Gail.
Thank you. The Fisheries Subcommittee will be meeting on January 8th, Monday the 8th. Correct.
Okay.
I just wanted to mention where I think I was talking to Dave Loring. So at the guide board meeting, it came up that there was 81 open investigations, and then 50 of those were for contracting register and master guides. And the chairman brought up that there's only 300 contracting guides, and we have 50 of them that are under investigation. That's 1/6 of all the contracting guides in the state.
So the ones that are caught.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, those are the ones that are under investigation. But I mean, I was shocked really that the number is that high, and they can't seem to
and they're doing all these consent agreements, you know, to avoid paying the legal fees. We're taking them to administrative court. So a lot of these guys, and then you look up, there's 12 on probation that have, they're out of their, out of compliance with their probation as well, where you have to have to pay a fine and some other penalty. And it's just, I'm just continually stopped that there's so many guys that are, you know, they don't want you. That's the thing. They ain't gonna sign. There's some guys that have had several violations and consent agreement after consent agreement, and then they pay their fine, and they don't want to lose guys. I mean, they want to keep. I mean, one thing came up. Get this. So one thing came up that really shocked me. So, and all of the guys on the board know this guy. I don't. They didn't mention the name because it's not public yet. But he's a long time master guy. He's been around for a long time. He took 5 moose hunters. They all got moose outside of this guy's youth area. So they're deliberating this, and they're saying, look, I know this guy's around. It was just a brain fart. You know, it happens to all of us. We forget to register the next year for a guide use area. He just forgot, and so he didn't register, and so he was out of compliance, and he took all his time. But to me, that would be a pretty big friggin' thing. Like, that's, you're a guide. You know what the regulations are. You know when you have to apply. He didn't do it. But he's been around for a while, and they're like, so we're going to, you know, it's going to be like a $2,000 fine. And this is what's happening. This is what I continually see happening. And there's just,
but
it's
underproduced. Yeah. Yeah, whether they did or not did that, he just crucified.
So was it that he forgot to renew that, or did he?
Forgot a year when it comes up when you have to register for a new guidance area, he forgot. Brain fart, that's what they said. He forgot, he didn't mean it, he just forgot. That's why I forgot to get my driver's license, and cop caught me, and give me a fine, and let me go and drive again. But it is really shocking about, you know, 81 open investigations, but it's just.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Gail.
Yeah, on a related issue, there was a hearing today. I didn't have time to track it down, and maybe Mike Kramer can help us track down what happened. But it was one of the first hearings, I think, on the violations for AM on the citations. And So, Mike, are you able to do that?
Yes, and actually all could track those, on CourtView, you know, the court system website. We know the names of the people that have been charged.
Yeah, I did do it right, so, and I didn't have to type it. Go ahead.
Yeah, you just need to type in the person's name and you'll see everything going on in their court case, at least a summary of it.
Okay, great. Yeah, because we need to find out.
I imagine, because there's so many of them, they're just going to keep kicking the can down the road, getting postponements until, you know, somebody pushes the issue, which might not be till the end of next fishing season. But, you know, I would expect a series of long delays and motions being filed and whatnot to stretch out the process till someone sticks their neck out and everyone else sees what happens to them. I did have one question. I'm sorry, it was an old agenda item when we were talking about the net pens. My audio wasn't working. Is Katie still on the call?
She is.
Yes.
So the proposal says storage and use. Those words "and use" really concern me because this seemingly would allow, you know, year round or summer long use of net pens to fatten up the pinks before they're released to compete with wild fish. And I thought net pens were outlawed when we began fish farming. Apparently there's some loophole that allows them to keep frying there until they fatten them up till they get perfect ocean conditions so they can outcompete wild fish. But, you know, storage is one thing, but using net pens, which is specifically in their proposal, is a whole different thing. And I am under no circumstances would support the use of net pens, you know, beyond a certain date, you know, whatever that date is, that they currently have to abide by to release those fish from those pens.
I can speak to that. We are no longer permitted to raise pink salmon, for one. We have no pink salmon on our permit, nor do we ever have the desire to raise pink salmon. So there's no concerns there. And use is just so that we can access the site and move things around. So we have to move our barge around quite a bit to be able to put fish food on it. But we would never want to raise fish past solstice because the water gets too hot and it's not a safe environment to live in. So our intentions are not to hold fish any longer than we normally would. We just literally don't have space to put them right now. So that's all that's going on there.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Kay, for that. And if I might, Mr. Chair, ask a question. As we write our comments in general about net pens, because Mike brought up the basic concern that we have, could you email me the intention of this so we have more clarification as we're writing up our comments?
Yes, I'm happy to. Yeah.
Okay, do you have my email address?
I do not. Unless it's on the AC website, I can get it from there. But if it's not there, I don't have it.
Okay, it's gkvsons@alaska.net. And,
I can see that.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much. That would be helpful. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Jarvis.
Gail or Mike, is there any historical precedent for the violators in Area M? What kind of punishments have been handed out in the past, and what would prospectively be handed out to these violators?
You know, that is a great question. And the short answer that I can think of right now is they haven't had any violations on those fishing grounds for a very long time, which is very suspicious just by itself. And that has to do with how big those grounds are and the just not the state troopers not being able to monitor it, that huge area. They did have a special monitoring on it this year. It's in that June fishery, so it's about 21 days or so. So there were some citations going back like 25 or 30 years, but it's been pretty blank since then. But if you go over to Bristol Bay, you'll get 50 or 60 citations. So it's kind of interesting. Mike, did you have a comment on that?
I don't, other than, you know, it is recent enforcement. I think prosecutors, you know, need to look towards how they've doled out penalties in the past. But this is a unique situation where, you know, the fleet specifically pushed, you know, their own self-monitoring and said they wouldn't be engaging in this behavior. And it turns out they engaged in it, you know, widespread all summer, and more than a handful got caught doing it. So, you know, I would hope that the prosecutors in the state would, you know, would take these violations in Area M this year, particularly with the chum crisis in AYK, and, you know, mete out some, you know, serious penalties that they might not have maybe in years past when someone chucked the chum in Bristol Bay, when there wasn't a chum crash all over the western Alaska coast. I would hope they can take that into account, and the penalty certainly would allow for it, but it's a matter of what have they done in the past and what special circumstances exist in this situation to either enhance or decrease the, you know, what might be considered the standard penalty for that behavior.
Take their boats. Hey, Mike, do you know, does that violation always go on the captain of the vessel?
I don't know the answer.
No, the citations were individual.
Oh, really?
Yep.
But the captain runs the boat, so that's sort of like the guy thing where the violation goes on the hunter rather than the guy then?
Well, I don't. That's a good question, Mark. I don't know if they were both cited, which is a possibility. But I do know that the citations were by individual name, and some were crew, and some were those boats are. They were mostly drift boats. There was one seiner, so the drift boats would have one or two crew. So maybe both were cited, which is probably the case.
Okay. Yeah, that's what you're saying. That's what they do for poachers, for boars. Take the boat. Take care of them. Jeff,
you want an update on the bison, what we did,
what we didn't do?
Yeah.
Can everybody hear me? So we didn't get very far on the bison. Minto and Manly were there. They were
kind of mixed, not in support of it. It seemed like some were, some weren't. We didn't finish the meeting. It started out with somebody spoke for the governor and said that the governor was in support of the bison. And then throughout the meeting, it kept coming up that the governor said. And everybody was like, well, we're getting this forced on us. We don't have any say in it now that he wants it. But anyway, we pushed through what we could. Some of the things that came out was there was a lot of space for disagreement. We made little progress. Working together, heard a lot of different ideas. One of the things that we brought up was the importance of having some people return so that not everybody's brand new on the working group every time. We go back a whole lot when we do that because, you know, they've got to learn what everybody else should know. And anyway, when we ended with another meeting. Tom said maybe February would be as soon as we could do it. I proposed that the governor or somebody that could speak for him be there so that, you know, we can stop putting what the governor said out there on the table every 15 minutes. And he would be there to, you know, or his spokesperson to tell us what he thought. We did decide if we did put bison out there, or when we do, it would be at the headwaters of the Kamtishna. So probably about 50 miles from Manly if you go in that way. It is kind of accessible compared to the Inopia, but still a little bit of a hunt if we ever got there. A lot of resistance in Minto and Manly. Seemed like they couldn't speak because they were going to have their meeting after this meeting. So a lot of the younger people seem to be in favor, but it's the elders that make the decisions, so they were going to go back and talk to them. So yeah, it wasn't the best meeting, but if we've got bison coming next year, so we need a place to put them. So I'll be there next week working on another group with the bison, and we'll see where we can get from that.
Was that the upper town now?
So, is everybody paid for it? So they're all recorded. So I don't know if you can go out there and see it. Well, we said that, but you know, it's kind of like you're going to be the spokesperson for us, and you've got to perform since the last guy's gone. Mm-hmm. And when I was new, I understand that, you know, people come in and have the same questions, but you know, after you get in there, to harp on the same questions over and over, it's just like you're dragging your feet. And hard to stay engaged when you're just waiting for everybody else to catch up. But, yeah, a lot of that this meeting. So,
is Dr. Bass the facilitator?
He was. I think he does a pretty good deal. He doesn't set an agenda. We set the agenda, and that's hard for a lot of people. They come into the meeting, and they don't understand what we're going to do and deciding everything. But that's kind of the way Tom wants it is, you know, we're making the plans, we're making the decisions. So, once you see it, it works.
Are you doing all the sticky notes all over the...
Yep, same as, you know, all the other ones. But I remember when I first went to the first one, the same thing was maybe what are we going to do? But that's what we're doing at the meeting. We're doing it all. So,
I think that's what it's doing.
Yeah. And it does come together like when you see the plan, how it works. But this one, we just couldn't get there. So, find a new place, another spot, and go with it.
That's too bad.
Yeah. Anybody have anything else? Mike, you have anything?
No.
Gail?
No, I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I make a motion to adjourn. 2053.
Thank you. Did you have any questions?